and outdoor applications. I always like to plug DeLorme because of this. They made a lot of money very quickly out of their mapping applications. They decided to locate in near Freeport, Maine, out there on I-95, and they built this headquarters. They started in what was little more than a shack, but they very quickly built this huge headquarters and a gift store and everything. But they thought that their signature construction would be this. They call it Eartha. It's a map of the Earth, or a globe, at an exact scale of 1 to 1 million, mounted on a central pivot that actually rotates. So it's about 4 stories high. You can go inside and get up on one of these big gantries and look down on this rotating Earth. So it's the DeLorme Map Company. Even UCSB, even UCSB Geography is in on the act in terms of creating and providing digital map data and then serving it out to a community. So here's one example of a project that Geography did in collaboration with the Cheadle Center for Biodiversity and Ecological Restoration, in which their volunteers over a couple of years cataloged every single plant, tree, shrub, bush, you name it, on campus, identified the species, identified how old it was, its condition, took photographs of the leaves and the flowers, and posted them in this database. Since they'd also pressed a GPS receiver and gotten the location, we were able to geo-enable this database. So you can now go into the Campus Flora project, click on any tree or any bush on the campus and see how old it is or when it was planted or what its condition is. Geography has been working on this, what the interactive campus map. Back a few years ago, there was one campus map that was used for pretty much everything. We decided Geography could do a better job of that, so we kind of took it over and are now serving out the interactive campus map that supplies everything from handicap access information to parking to where all the recycling bins are and how strong the wireless signal is at every point on campus. Okay, so what I want to do now is just give you a sort of snapshot of GIS data that's kind of sitting out there just waiting for you to take advantage of it. Most of this is without cost. It's a freebie. Not all of it is without cost. Some has a nominal cost, which is usually a small fee for downloading data, like say $10. Some of it is extremely expensive, and this expense can be prohibitive. More about that in just a minute. Access. Sometimes the data is just sitting out there on a server and you can just connect and download it. Sometimes all you get is a form that you have to fill out and then submit, and you might have to wait a couple of weeks and you get an email back, perhaps inviting you to go to a website to download the information. So all sorts of different levels of access. The original concept behind global level access was this idea of the GSDI, or the Global Spatial Data Infrastructure. And the idea there was that all of the map producing agencies, like the federal mapping authorities of each country, if they all produce maps to common standard, there ought to be a system that allows you to go in and pull down data for anywhere in the world that you want. And if you want to do something complicated, like actually take, say, 4 adjacent countries in Africa and bring all of their data down as part of a search rectangle rather than nation by nation, you should be able to do that. Haven't quite realized that yet, but we're well along the way to doing so. The lead agency within the Global Spatial Data Infrastructure that provided the sort of base reference level that got the project started was NGA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Actually, its precursor agency was called NIMA, National Imagery and Mapping Agency. And they started back in the 90s, 92 in fact, by posting VMAP Zero, the digital map of the world that they use for their own military mapping, posting it out to the world and making it available for free as world-level data. It was 14 layers of information, a lot of it highly specialized, you know, airfields and so on, but some of it very useful, outlines of major metropolitan areas, transportation and pipelines, coastlines, those kinds of things. That sort of task, the idea of supporting a world map that's several themes deep, was taken up by the Japanese. in what they call the global map, that's a product of something called the ISCGM, the International Steering Committee for Global Map, which still has a website and is still operational. And they're now, in fact, on about their third generation of revising the world map to make it available globally at a scale of about 1 to 1 million, sometimes a little bit better. The system they set up was actually quite ingenious because they lobbied through the United Nations, they held a series of conferences and invited the mapping agencies of all the different countries in the world. And then they invited membership at different levels. So you could, at the base level, you would just map your own country and contribute your own data. At the top level, you would map your own country, contribute your own data, and then adopt another country. And at the bottom level, you would be adopted and allow yourself to be mapped by some other country, and then that those data contributed. And as a result of that, the map, the global map, is now pretty much complete. And it's quite impressive. It's worth taking a look. It's largely public domain data, but you do need to register to be able to download it. Going down my list here, NASA WorldWind was a piece of software that predated Google Earth, or actually the precursor to Google Earth, called Keyhole Earth something, Earth Viewer, Keyhole Earth Viewer. NASA was the first to put out the piece of software that allowed you to do the sorts of things you now do easily within Google Earth. And their goal was to be able to put in all of the public domain data from the US government, all of the data that NASA holds from all of its remote sensing instruments, not only for the Earth, but also for the sky and for all the other planets. So all of the NASA data was posted into this NASA WorldWind system. It's still, NASA WorldWind still exists, it's still usable. It's pretty impressive, but it's largely become a sort of user-developer API environment now for developing other applications. That's a Java-based application. We've got GDEM and SRTM. I'm going to talk about those separately in just a minute, but those are global topographic databases of two different generations that are pretty detailed. They have detailed resolution, 90 and 30 meters on the ground. Of postings of elevations for every country in the world, or almost every country in the world. Then we have some degree of guidance from the United Nations. The United Nations does have a small mapping division, but it has member agencies like the UNEP, the Environmental Program, and the Children's Fund, the UNICEF. These collect data globally and distribute it on a mapping basis. The UN also has the difficult responsibility of producing definitive the political boundary maps in areas where there are boundary disputes. So a lot of times the UN map is the sort of ultimate source of information about where boundaries are located. There are, now clearinghouses, there are just a huge number, and they're generally speaking topical. So we can go to, you know, weather.com, for example, and see, or begin to see the agencies that are contributing weather data, like the National Weather Service, on a regular basis. There are themes by like natural hazards, earthquakes. USGS operates a global earthquakes database. Topography, I just mentioned, and many others, generally speaking by theme. And then we have some databases that are continental in scope. They're international, but they're not global. And good examples here are the africover.org database for Africa, which is primarily supplying land use and land cover data for Africa on a very regular and updated basis, mostly from the MODIS satellites. And then projects like the CAREEN project in the European Union, which is a mapping project related to the member nations of the European Union, in which land use maps and basic country maps of political units, transportation, and so on, are created on a country-by-country basis, but then seamed together for all of the EU countries. And those include land use, and they're really quite effectively done. Not universally available, so it's fairly typical for Europe. You have to go in and register, and generally you need some affiliation or a project that you're doing to get access to the information, but it is provided to you when you ask for it. Okay, so that brings us here to the United States. The US federal agencies that do mapping of not just United States, but also the world, include the following. United States Geological Survey, whose primary function, its national mapping program, now called the Geography Division, has the primary responsibility for mapping inside the United States and its territories and providing those maps to the public. So they're the principal mapping production agency in the United States, but they're certainly not the only one. NOAA, under its various different agencies, that's National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, has a responsibility for commerce in the United States, so things like navigable waterways, harbor charts, airline charts, but also weather information, radar, the kind of maps that you see on the news when you're seeing weather information, generally speaking, are coming from some branch of NOAA, usually the National Weather Service, or occasionally other agencies. Our Census Bureau, I've already mentioned, as having its proprietary, or not proprietary, but its sort of trademark format, TIGER, we looked at in the last lecture. The Census Bureau's responsibility is to collect data about the United States, primarily to do redistricting after each decennial census. That's actually guaranteed in the Constitution. They have to count all the Americans and then partition or provide information to allow the states to partition themselves such that each voting citizen has equal representation in Congress, with one or two twists in there. So the Census Bureau obviously doesn't just count people, it counts immense depth in terms of demography, you know, age, sex, ethnic, and so on distributions for the whole population. A lot of information on migration, increasingly information on jobs, employment, housing condition, and so on is all coming out of the Census Bureau. They've now gone over to an annual survey format for a sample, the so-called American Community Survey, which means their data is getting better and better all the time. The next one is, ironically, probably the largest mapping agency in the United States. Just one of their units in St. Louis has over 1,500 cartographers employed. That's the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, or the NGA. They are responsible for mapping primarily for defense and national security purposes, everything outside the 50 United States and its territories. So US-based maps of the rest of the world, and I really do mean the rest of the world at some detailed scales, including imagery and navigation information, nautical charts and so on, all comes out of the NGA. And they run their own website and to a great extent distribute their own data. They even have their own open source software that can read their data and allow you to display it on your computer. Then we have the Environmental Protection Agency. It has specific charges, like, say, managing the Superfund sites or dealing with environmental legislation. They produce a large amount of geospatial data and they publish it usually on the web. Recently, FEMA has been very much in the public eye because of its management of national emergencies, or its failure to manage national emergencies. FEMA is also responsible for one of the largest mapping programs in the country, the Digital Flood Insurance Risk Mapping Program, or the DFIRM. And that program produces all the estimates of how likely any property in the United States is to experience extreme floods. And you have to figure that risk out before you buy or sell any piece of property, because that determines whether or not you need to buy flood insurance. Extremely important series of maps, and many, many more. Of course, almost all federal agencies are in the mapping business to some degree. I mentioned the global spatial data infrastructure. The global spatial data infrastructure was modeled on the US's national spatial data infrastructure, a program that dates back to the 1990s that came out of a series of government programs but was coordinated by something called the Federal Geographic Data Committee. The Federal Geographic Data Committee was commissioned, it was designed to be a cross-agency. Each agency would send representatives to it, and they would talk about what data they needed and be able to sort of broker and share data, or at least delegate responsibilities. And it was this impetus that that led to some of the standards programs that I mentioned briefly last time, the data exchange standards, and this agency remains fairly active. For one thing, it's managed what's called the National Spatial Data Clearinghouse. So the National Spatial Data Infrastructure is data, is out there. What's our portal, or what's our way of discovery and access to that massive data that's contained by the federal government? Well, it's through the National Spatial Data Clearinghouse. And we already had a few portals into this that the data committee had provided, but starting in the Clinton administration and then really starting big time when Obama was elected, we've seen these what they call eGov initiatives, although they date back originally to 2002. Now, eGov initiatives, one of them was around geospatial data, and it led to data.gov, geodata.gov, and these national clearinghouses for spatial data. So we can go into, say, one of these, we can look at what level we want to get information. For example, it says fire mapping here. We might want to collect or find everything to do with fires. And then there's a query over here that says what, for example, a river, and where, for example, a town or a county. As long as we do that, we can drive down into the database to a particular type of data, and it'll say, oh, if you want coverage for that county or that town, you can get the roads from the Department of Transportation, you can get the land use from the USGS, you can get the topography from NASA, you can get the flood risk map from FEMA, and so on. So you'd be able to gather together all the data, even though it's actually spread across a large number of different agencies. Now, the United States Geological Survey, they call it now, it's a geography division, but its National Mapping Program, which existed for many years, converting the USGS maps into digital form so they could be used with GIS, over the years created quite literally a staggering amount of data. I'll show you where it all lives in just a minute. But its principal topics are things like land cover, satellite imagery, elevation data, maps, information about the public land survey system, and so on. All of this is available and can be just simply searched for and downloaded. Starting about, when would it be now? About 9 or 10 years ago, they decided that what they needed was a really nice portal in front of all their data so that it was easy to search. And the concept they came up with was called the National Map, which was basically all the data that already existed. And they created on top of it a portal called the National Map Viewer. And if this is just at viewer.nationalmap.gov, if you just go to that website, this map will launch. On the right-hand side, we have a map of the US, and we can control what we display. We can look at imagery, just like in Google Earth and so on. We've got a little zoom indicator, so we can zoom right in, or we've got a search engine at the top, so if we want a particular county, if we want to go to Goleta or Isla Vista, California, we can go straight to it. And on the left-hand side, we have a whole series of themes for which they have maps and information available, like topographic maps, geographic names, buildings, transportation, government unit boundaries, scanned topographic maps, contours, and so on and so forth. All of these layers are sitting there waiting for you to access them. So here, I just pulled up a few screens today just to show you. I went to Goleta, California, showed me that area that's on the stream right now, on the screen. And here I asked for land use, place names, and transportation. So in the background, I've got a colored rendering of the land use, in which different shades of red, for example, are the urban areas. I've got place names for pretty much everything: Glen Annie Ranch, Historical, Santa Barbara Municipal Airport, San Jose Creek, and so on. All the place names are there. And then all the transportation, all the streets, the railroads, even the pipelines, and highways and highway numbers are all located here. If I now want to download this, I simply go over to the download data window and say, yeah, these are the themes I'm looking at, these are the ones I want, and they download and are available to immediately ingest into your GIS. In fact, you can even download them in ArcGIS format. Now, some of the more interesting things, since we've just been looking at the difference between raster and vector, are two different renderings of all of the map data of the United States. All of the historical maps, all the historical topographic maps, have simply been scanned and turned into digital raster graphics. So we can download all the maps as images to use as sort of backdrops in any analysis that we want to do. But a new generation of maps called US Topo, which is the latest version of each quadrangle map, is actually vector data in a very particular format, a GeoPDF format, that again can only now, with the new version of ArcGIS, be downloaded and ingested directly as vectors into ArcGIS. So really quite remarkable in what we can get for the US. And then probably one of the more impressive aspects, impressive because you don't realize when you see it in Google Earth that this is where it's coming from. Google Earth just simply rips off every government agency that already provides data and then serves out the data as its own. The DOQQ stands for the Digital Orthophoto Quarter Quadrangles. These are 1 to 12,000 equivalent images or photographs of the entire country, which are updated every 5 years, with about a 1 meter ground resolution. So they're really quite detailed. And we can zip right down to any particular area, and again, click download and bring these down and bring them directly into ArcGIS. So if we want high resolution imagery, color or black and white, we can download that very simply. Okay, another thing we can do, it used to be on a separate server, but this function has now been placed into the National Map Viewer, and that's to do what's called seamless download. I talked about the mosaicing problem in GIS, that if we have a collection of data, in this case it's been tiled by the quadrangles of the different mapping series at the different scales, 1 to 24,000, 1 to 100,000, 1 to 1,000,000, and so on. What we would like to do is get rid of all the boundaries between the maps. And in fact, we can now do that. We can do what's called a seamless download. So we can extract data from the database by saying, go to a point, and I say, give me everything within 10 miles of this point. Or I could go to a particular map and say, go to the Goleta, California quadrangle, and I want that map. Go to a region such as Santa Barbara County or Southern California. Or I can draw my own polygon and say, I draw my own polygon that's the Los Padres National Forest. And now I say, take that back to your server, cut it out of the master data set, and give me my own data set that contains the layers that I want just for that region. So this cutting out and mosaicing function is now done on the server side. You don't have to do it yourself inside the GIS. It saves an awful lot of time. Well, when you do that, typically the file you create is enormous, and you're certainly not going to just download it by clicking on your browser. So what it does is it says, okay, I've got your query, thank you very much. Type your email in here, and in a little time, and it's usually 5 to 10 minutes, it happens automatically, you'll get an email with a link to a zip file that contains your information. It'll stay on their server end for 2 days. Hopefully you'll download it sometime during those 2 days. And bear in mind what you're doing here. So if you go in tonight, let's say, and say, I want the 1 meter digital orthophoto quadrangle for all of Santa Barbara County. Just think for a minute how many pixels that involves and how much data that is going to entail. It's probably terabytes. So it's much better to have small amounts of data. The data are zipped together, they're usually in zip files. They're structured by layer, so when they come in, they are themes within. They come in one at a time into ArcGIS. And the processes are automated, but as I said, the requests are efficient, but they can get very large very quick. So often you'll get a little pop-up window that says, sort of, did you notice the data set you just created is 1.7 petabytes? Are you sure you want to download this? It's going to take you a little while over wireless. Okay, I mentioned the GeoPDF format files. This map store is a new addition to the USGS's site in which we can now query on a quadrangle basis or by mapping program. They've recently added, as it says here, 90,000 maps from the historical map collection. So they went back and scanned every historical edition of every topographic map going back to the 1800s and loaded them all in the same way. And those are all now available and accessible. Okay, let's take a look at the Census Bureau. The Census Bureau, under its geography files, of course, it also has data files that you can download that represent all of the raw nuts and bolts statistics of the census. The key part is what they call cartographic boundary files. Those are maintained on their own servers, And they're generally structured by state, by minor civil division, by county, and to some extent by region. And they're just, some of them are immensely detailed. Some of them go down to the individual tract level. And again, you can download them. These are vector files. They come down in the shape format, the SHP file format, that comes directly into ArcGIS. What they don't do, unfortunately, is link them into the attribute data that are in the population tables. That becomes your responsibility. It's one of the things is often done as a GIS lab. Some of the other agencies that supply data, I'm going to cover these briefly, but it doesn't mean they're unimportant. They supply immense quantities of data. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration handles everything to do with navigation, safety of transit, harbor charts, weather, everything, some risk information, fisheries and so on. All of that information is located in their weather, in their sites. Just a staggering amount of information. For example, the National Geophysical Data Center, which has a lot of good topographic and magnetic and so on information, is part of NOAA, as is the Bureau of Commerce, Department of Commerce, and other agencies. Now, this slide's a little bit out of order, but from the NASA and the USGS point of view, most of the data gets archived in what are called data centers. So NASA has taken this process. It has what it calls information centers, distributed active archive centers, DACs, and it has one for the Earth resources, one for planetary, one for the atmosphere, and so on. And that's distributed around the country so that no one server has to take the whole load for everything. For the USGS, almost all of their server activity takes place in one place, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the second most visited tourist spot in the state of South Dakota, after the mountain there with the president's faces. It's operated by the USGS. It is a land processes DAC for NASA, Distributed Active Archive Center, and it's just basically a building in the middle of nowhere. They deliberately chose it to be far away from any city or any location, so it was strategically safe. It is nuclear fallout proof. All of the data are archived underground, but it has these massive arrays of servers that are actually doing those clipping operations when you ask for your data set. So if you ever find yourself in South Dakota, I'd recommend taking the public tour. It's quite interesting. USGS, as I mentioned, got started first on providing digital data. They still maintain all of the projects that were underway before their National Map project began. And these include digital elevation models, which have now become the National Elevation Data Set, which is now at 15, 10, and increasingly higher resolution. The data at 1 to 2 million, these are called the National Atlas maps that cover the country with quite a lot of detail and all sorts of interesting things. Yeah?
When did they first start supplying digital data?
The USGS? Yeah. My best guess would be about 1973 or so. They sort of started the programs big time in the late 70s. And they really got launched in the early 80s, but they didn't finish the digital conversion until the mid 90s. So up until then, they were still dealing primarily with paper maps. And other things like the digital line graphs, which we've looked at, the land use and land cover maps, which have now dated back over time. So we've got several time slices. We can look at land use change in the US, look at, say, loss of farmland or growth of urban areas. And they also supply something called the National Hydrography Data Set, which is every river, every stream, every tiny reach of every stream in the nation, all coded into an elaborate data structure. We shouldn't ignore some of the important databases like GNIS. GNIS, I always say, was the very first GIS. The first thing the USGS did to convert its maps back in the early 80s was to contract out the reading of every piece of text on every map that the USGS produced, the conversion of that to a digital file with the location of where that text was and what type of feature was represented. So this now represents an enormous database, and there's a portal into it so that we can type queries like, how many lakes in the U.S. have my last name as their as part of their name, or how many places in the U.S. are called nowhere, those kinds of things. And the level of detail is extraordinary. So here are features that are airports, buildings, cemeteries, capes, civil divisions, hospitals. Pretty much anything that appears on a map that is named is also in this database. Very valuable data set. For the rest of the world, this becomes a little problematic. For one thing, now we have to support multiple languages because place names elsewhere have to ideally have the language of the nation, but we also anglicize their names, or at least put them into the Roman alphabet. These are dealt with in something called the GeoNames server, or the GNS. This is a server that's maintained by NGA that contains every place name in the world and all the variants on that place name and that place name in every language that you could possibly imagine. And if you don't believe me, just go and take a look at it. It's quite staggering, the amount of detail that's in this database. Here's an interesting one. Metacarta.com is a site that's come out of the intelligence world. And it creates software that allows geo-search. So that means identify a place name, let's say London. And this does not geographic search for the place London, but it mines every document in HTML out there on the internet to see whether or not it contains the word London that's probably referring to the place London, and gives you back that content. So that's a geo-search. Geotagging means that you can go out to any particular subset of the internet and replace, every time it finds a place name in any text document, it embeds after the place name its georeference, its latitude and longitude. So now when I search on latitude and longitude, I can find the same document. It's really pretty extraordinary. I've seen databases that this has worked on. It's just awesome. And then geotagging, or adding geographic coordinates to things, is happening all the time now. My iPhone, every time I take a photograph, without me realizing it, it reads the GPS chip and tags the photo with where I took it. If I then upload it to, say, Wikimapia, the image appears in its actual location, where I took the picture. And almost all of the current generation digital cameras will do the same thing. So we can go into something like here, I'm looking at Google Earth, and I can turn on the image layer and see where people have taken photographs that they've posted and made available through, in this case, Flickr, I believe it is, or any of the other photo services. So this is a different type of georeference content, but it's also publicly available and it's out there and useful. Same thing for webcams. Not many interesting webcams pop up, but the one at the East Gate always does pop up, and there are actually several on campus, and you can find them through, in this case, Google Earth, but there are other ways to find them. Okay, let's talk for a little bit about terrain data. There's just simply no shortage of terrain data. Terrain data is obviously very important because it's about elevations on the Earth's surface, which gives us all sorts of additional information. So terrain data, we looked briefly at the digital elevation models last time, but there are also digital line graphs, and the US topo also encode contour lines. So those give us information about elevation. DCW, the Digital Chart of the World, gave us our first worldwide contours. But since then, we've had two critical mapping missions from space that have given us much better topographic information. The first of these, the Shuttle radar topographic mapping mission, which took place in the mid-1990s and mapped the entire Earth other than the polar regions on the north and the south, and returned an elevation about every 30 meters on the surface, although the public version is about every 90 meters on the surface. That got some criticism, plus it was beginning to get out of date. Recently, we've seen a new world database, the Global Digital Elevation Model, that's been backed out of other satellite information that nevertheless collects data about elevation. So the GDAM, if you want to go to it, just take a look at it. This is the J-Space Systems, the NASA database for downloading their data. This comes from the ASTA satellite. So they process the ASTA imagery to extract terrain information from it. Now, it's available for the whole world at extremely high resolution. It's partitioned into tiles. So the search mechanism is that you go into a website where you find the particular tile you're interested in downloading. You click on that tile, you download it, and now your usually latitude, longitude range of that tile comes up for display in your GIS. This is extremely accurate elevation data, really, really very good. Okay, this is where I wanted to get to. Unfortunately, I've got 2 minutes to cover it. And this is about spatial data rights. In a way, we're extremely lucky in the United States because federal law is very, I want to say forward-looking, it's very fair, you might say, about access. So under the FOIA, or the Freedom of Information Act, it was determined, maybe like 30 years ago now, that any piece of information the government had collected at public expense could not be withheld from the general public unless it was a concern of national security. And furthermore, you couldn't charge the public for buying data that had been created at public expense. You could only charge what was called the marginal cost of distribution. So if it was on a CD, you could pay for burning the CD, but you couldn't pay for the data. Well, this is a very enlightened way of distributing data. Once the internet came along, the federal agencies loved it because it meant that when they could put all their data up on the internet, they didn't have to pay for all these public requests for information that they had to service one by one. They can just post all their data sets and say, here it is, take it, you know, it's yours. And of course, anybody can access through the federal government sites. And we have this, I always call it a beautiful irony, that the chief customer for USGS paper maps through the entire Cold War was the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. Once a month, they would show up and buy every new map. And they were quite entitled to it because they were under FOIA. COFOR here means the cost of fulfilling a user request. So you can't be charged anything more than the cost of fulfilling a user request